Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Market Volatility Conference Call. I would now like to turn the meeting over to Mike Evans, Regional Vice President, Retail Sales. Please go ahead, Mr. Evans.
Thanks, Justine. Appreciate that. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's call. We appreciate you taking the time to join us, and we've heard firsthand from you that you value timely information on market developments from your partners. And we recognize that you have many clients and prospects concerned about the coronavirus and the impact the pandemic is having on world markets. Each week, we're committed to bringing you relevant commentary from both a macroeconomic and portfolio management perspective on current market developments. Today, you'll hear from two senior members of Mackenzie's investment team. Paul Taylor is with us today. He's the Vice President, Investment Management and Portfolio Manager on Mackenzie's Multi-Asset Strategies team, a member of Mackenzie's Global Investment Committee. Paul is an industry veteran with more than 30 years of investment experience and joined Mackenzie in October of 2019. He'll provide us with a macroeconomic perspective of Corona and the global fiscal and monetary response to it. Also on this afternoon's call is Alan Sechuk, Vice President and Senior Investment Director with Mackenzie's Alternative Investments team. Alan joined Mackenzie in 2015 and played a critical role in the development of products catering to the needs of the Canadian retirement market. Alan will provide us with a detailed update on our monthly income portfolios, funds specifically designed to meet the needs of Canadian retirees. Now, a little details on the call. Today's call is being recorded, and there will be a playback made available to everyone on the call directly after by your Mackenzie sales team. After the formal comments in our presentation, we will have a moderated Q&A to allow you the opportunity to ask and get answers to anything that's on your mind. We'll do our best to answer as many of those questions as possible, but if we don't address yours, please send that through to your Mackenzie sales team, and we'll get you a response. Well, good afternoon, gentlemen. Lots to cover today. So, Paul, things are changing rapidly. Record jobless numbers in the U.S. and Canada over the last few weeks. An equally powerful fiscal and monetary response by governments. The majority of the developed world is in lockdown from Corona, and yet we've had one of the best weeks performance-wise in the last 50 years. Let's get your assessment on where we are in relation to the evolution of this crisis.
Thanks, Mike, and I'm hoping we do this more often, Mike, because when I do it of late, and there was a while there when every time you and I got up in front of an audience, there was a significant red on the screen, but that seems to have reversed itself. So we seem to have good luck these days. And yeah, you know, when you talk about the evolution, it's really interesting for us to keep in mind that, you know, this is really a 5-6 week phenomena in terms of it really getting caught, you know, by the markets, and the market obviously focusing on the global economic and capital market implications of COVID-19. So it's just interesting to see how quickly things have progressed, both in terms of the drawdown, which is, I think, you know, entirely justified because of, again, the global, the pervasive nature of the global health crisis that we face. And then, you know, the snapback that we've seen, you know, I think it's a really useful juncture to step back and just ask the question, okay, kind of where are we? And the question that I'm going to pose is I think the one that's on everyone's mind, and that is, you know, are we at a market bottom, you know, or have we seen the market bottom? It would be, I mean, I'll state this right up front. There's really only been one prior episode where we've seen a true V-shaped bottom in equity markets in a situation similar to this. I hope you don't ask me afterwards, I forget which time period it is. But typically, you know, we don't form a V-shaped bottom. Typically, it's more W-shaped, which would imply that maybe they're just from a technical perspective, that we might expect to retest the lows. But But this is a very unusual situation. So again, you know, I think the way to go about it is to say, okay, you know, equity market bottom, you know, kind of, are we there yet? You know, like the kids in the back of the car as you go to Florida, you know, we're kind of going, okay, you know, are we in Georgia or are we, you know, in Kentucky? And those have different, you know, a different feel to them. So, the three, things that I think we need to focus on, and this really reflects certainly a lot of the discussion we've had at McKinsey's global, investment committee level. The three things are, first off, obviously, you know, the global health crisis itself and equity markets will not bottom, not truly put in a lasting, enduring bottom until we know that we have containment. We'll talk a little bit about that. We'll come back to that. The second is we need to make sure that markets aren't seizing up, that we have well-functioning markets. And obviously in the great financial crisis, at a certain point, the markets just went no bid. And by that, I mean both equity markets, fixed income markets. And we had a further discussion. Actually, we had a global investment committee meeting this morning and got an update on where we are from a market perspective. And then the third, last but not least, is this will have had an economic impact. There's no doubt about that. And that is the timeliness and the magnitude of the stimulus response to mitigate or offset the economic impact of the coronavirus. So let's just go into each of those three areas. And then what I'll do is before, you know, I pass it back to you, Mike, and I'm interested, frankly, to hear Alan's discussion of monthly income portfolios, which have been purpose-built for conditions like what we've seen. I'll talk a little bit about, you know, where the markets are, which is really, you know, really now getting to the nitty gritty of valuation. You know, because prior to this, I don't think they, really any attempt prior to where we are right now to pin earnings or multiple for say the S&P 500, a complete waste of time. So let me come back. First issue, the global health crisis. We know everyone watches, you know, Donald Trump's task force, however you want to refer to them, his bashing of the press, which is what typically happens. But, you know, we watch them to get the very important information as it relates to, in particular, the U.S. We want to hear how the health crisis is evolving, you know, across the U.S., both on the East and the West Coast, and the big metropolitan areas where it's been such a big issue, and then of course, you know, through the rest of America. Just a couple of comments. I'm not going to go into too much detail, but you know, I'll state the obvious, and that is, policymakers could not avoid and ignore, you know, this global health crisis, and they couldn't for two reasons. You know, one is, it's very different than the seasonal flu because it's much more lethal than the seasonal flu. That's one. And the other is it's the transmission rate is so much higher than the seasonal flu, which that cocktail, that combination of factors is what has caused policymakers everywhere to make the right policy decision and to say, we have to save lives. And to do so, unfortunately, we have to literally put the economy, the global economy, in a coma and come to a standstill to get by this health crisis. The cure for this is obviously the social distancing. And where we are, you know, is that the market is coming to the conclusion that containment is at least it's on the horizon. And by that, you know the statistics. You've seen, you know, Italy peaking out about 2.5 weeks ago in terms of the number of new cases. We're seeing that the U.S. is crested or appears to have crested probably on the weekend. Of course, it's very, 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 very lopsided, you know, as you go across different regions of the U.S. Canada has topped out in the number of new cases, as appears to have plateaued. But that's the first thing, and that's the most obvious. We know we have to get to a point where through social distancing, the number of new cases that we identify every day has plateaued and is moving lower. And the fact that we're testing more people is, you know, a double positive, because you're testing more people and fewer people are being diagnosed each day in terms of new cases. That is huge. There are a couple of other pieces in terms of the health crisis itself. In terms of going back to work, yes, you need to see a cresting in new cases. You need to certainly see a cresting in the very unfortunate statistic, which is the number of people each day that are perishing as a result of exposure to COVID-19. Those are obvious. But the other pieces that are critical are obviously are testing. If we're to go back to work, we have to have a way of very quickly picking up on anyone who does develop symptoms of the coronavirus and ask them to self-isolate. We also need to have a hospital capacity that is freed up such that if there are, or whatever cases do spring up in second or subsequent waves, that we have the capacity to deal with them. So these are some of the things that need to take place. But, you know, the real focus is, does social distancing work in flattening the curve, or we want to refer to it? And we've seen that there in China, in South Korea, in Italy, in France, in Spain. France is a little bit of a choppy evidence. But, you know, in New York State, New York City, certainly that is the case. So the good news is, in terms of the equity markets bottoming, they cannot bottom. They absolutely, categorically cannot bottom in any enduring way until we have some semblance of containment. And I would argue, you know, that it's pretty clear that we're approaching that, and the bounce in equity markets is reflective of that. That's the first thing, and that's absolutely a kind of conditions precedent. The second is well-functioning capital markets. I've done a couple of other calls. I'm not going to go into this in too much detail, but I will reference that, you know, in the Great Financial Crisis, there was a point in time where, you know, that was a crisis of confidence, where at a certain point in time, you know, for any value, any money, any bid, any offer, the market just simply seized up, and investors, institutional retail investors, exited the market. And when that happens, you know, you're in a really tough spot. And we were concerned about that. There was no question. About three weeks ago, we saw high yield spreads, you know, move from pretty tight levels to extreme levels. There was the concern that the market was in the midst of becoming dysfunctional and going no bid. And then we saw, of course, the Fed in a very forceful way across a whole bunch of different portals, you know, try to hit the market to ensure that, in fact, we continue to trade in orderly fashion. So that's less a concern for us. We still monitor, in particular, high yield, and certainly other areas like the U.S. muni market is an area of big concern. A little bit of a concern here in Canada, because, you know, municipalities, you know, across North America have been hit, you know, with huge extra costs, and there'll be some property tax, you know, deferrals that will take place. And but, you know, the broad story from a market functioning perspective is that we think we're in a better spot, and that's less a concern. The third is just the timeliness and magnitude of the response. And there I've sort of already referenced, you know, the monetary policy response to keep markets functioning. The other part of the monetary policy response, obviously, is the Fed moving rates down to obviously ease financial conditions. But the other big one is, of course, the $2 trillion package to individuals and to businesses to attempt to offset the impact, the negative impact that we've seen from, you know, folks sitting at home, like all of us, who are not going out and spending money in restaurants and going to movies and going on vacations and things like that. The measurement that I use, which I think is a good, really broad, back of the envelope estimate of the, you know, the adequacy of fiscal stimulus, is that if you take the $2.1 trillion stimulus package and you compare that to the total size of the U.S. economy, so U.S. GDP to end of Q3 2019, about a $21 trillion economy. So really simple math, it's about 10% of GDP. If it appears, and this is the way it appears now, if it appears that sometime in May, we will get the start of a return to work order, and it will be graduated and it will take some time, but that'll mean that we've had a meaningful part of, say, the U.S. economy that's been at home for, call it, you know, 10, maybe 11, 12 weeks out of the year. Now, 10, 11, 12 weeks is more than 10% of the year, but, you know, roughly speaking, you know, just back of the envelope, the size of the stimulus is, I would argue, is in the right ballpark in trying to offset the economic implications of the coronavirus. So, and the other is that it's timely, that we're actually getting people receiving checks, you know, in the very near future. So those three things, I think, are what we need to see. I've said we have, you know, we have well-functioning capital markets. I do believe the response has been both timely and in terms of magnitude, it's sufficient. So I'd give those both a positive check mark. The global health crisis, I would argue, you know, a week ago, we would have said it would have been a half check mark. I would argue it's kind of two-thirds of a check mark now. So, you know, I think we're in the process of starting to form some sort of a bottom. I think that's a good news, but there's still a lot of stuff that needs to tie together from here. I can talk more about whether the current valuation is reasonable or not, but maybe in the interest of time, Mike, maybe I'll just sort of pull it together there. So just, you know, in conclusion, we're definitely, I think, approaching what appears to be containment of the virus. We have well-functioning capital markets, and we've had a very timely and large response to it that I think comes a long way towards mitigating the bulk of the or a meaningful part of the effect of the coronavirus. We can maybe talk more when we get into the Q&A session, Mike, but let me turn it back to you there now.
Yeah, great, Paul. Thanks for that. And I do like the framework you utilize, sort of the three-point process on what do we need to kind of grapple with the crisis and come out at the other side. A lot of people are asking and wondering about, you know, what does it look like? What is normal? How do we get back there? So no doubt there'll be some interesting questions. So I appreciate your comments. It's amazing, though, how far we've come in such a short time. As you mentioned, markets in late February were hitting all-time highs, and look where we are now, which in many ways creates the perfect segue to the second half of today's call, a detailed update on the monthly income portfolios, a product, as many of you know, and as you mentioned, Paul, designed to dovetail with the specific needs of retirees, you know, those being generating income, providing growth opportunities, and protecting on the downside effectively. Ultimately, the goal is to smooth the ride, smooth the performance profile and experience profile that investors have through market events like the one we're seeing right now, through a full market cycle. So, Alan, welcome. I'm glad you're here. Excited to have you on today's call. This is our second big test. I would say this is really the biggest of the big tests. But along with Q4 2018, the monthly income portfolios have held up well in stressful market conditions. Why don't we start with that and have a little look at performance and the delivery of the experience that we intended for investors?
Yes. Thanks a lot, Mike. Thanks for having me on this national call today. Good afternoon, everybody. We will talk about performance. Just before we get there, I mean, I'd just like to step back. I'm certainly pleased to hear my colleague, Paul Taylor, tell us that the pieces of recovery are falling into place. Maybe not all there yet, but getting there. But we're going to see some more volatility along the way. So I think, Mike, you and I are going to talk a little bit today about downside protection in general, right, and the strategies we use to incorporate downside protection within our monthly income portfolios. But most importantly, I think, you know, through this whole experience, both the down and the up, really about how the use of downside protection doesn't have to mean moving to the sidelines, going to cash or something like that, and then sitting out a subsequent market recovery. And I think that's really one of the important points that, that hopefully you and I can discuss. But in terms of performance, which is the first thing we want to discuss today, I wanted to talk a little bit about how these portfolios did over the course of the downturn and then, you know, follow up with how did they do that. As a reminder, there's two portfolios we're talking about. There's a balanced version of the monthly income portfolios that's roughly 60% equities, 40% fixed income, and a conservative version that's simply the reverse, 40% equities, 60% fixed income. So I'm going to be talking about both of those portfolios throughout these the next few minutes. The balanced portfolio sits in a peer group in the Canadian Balanced Mutual Fund landscape, the Global Neutral Balanced Peer Group, and the conservative portfolio sits within the Global Fixed Income Peer Group. So we're going to be talking both about the absolute returns that these portfolios generated throughout the downturn, and then also how they did relative to the other funds within their respective peer groups. And the question is, were they successful in meeting their objectives? And I'm happy to say, yes, they were very much successful in meeting their objectives. The sell-off began the week of February 24th and went for about 6 weeks into that last week of March, first few days of April. And on a peak-to-trough basis, we saw equity markets decline by about 34-35%, depending on which index you look at. That means that over that period, the median fund in the global neutral balance category was down 19.4%, so almost 20%. The monthly income balance portfolio was down 9.4%, so about half the decline you saw in its respective category. Similarly, in the global fixed income balance category, that median performer in that category declined just over 14%, and the monthly income conservative fund on a peak-to-trough basis declined 6.4%. So again, less than half of the decline of the category. So these are peak-to-trough returns. The same thing happened if you look at the month of March as a whole. Both the balanced and the conservative portfolio delivered about half the decline of the category or better. So that's on an absolute basis, Mike. On a relative basis, here's where the performance really stands out, because we are measuring their performance in terms of the percentage of the peers or other funds in the category that they beat in these periods. In March alone, both portfolios beat 94% of all the other peers in each respective category. So that means they did better than 19 out of every 20 funds in the peer group, specifically because they're designed to hold up better when we get a big bear market like we just had. And then if you look at on a weekly basis throughout every week of the downturn as we move through March and into the beginning of April, the percent of peers beaten ranged between 91% to 99% of peers beaten. So, you know, during those times when you really needed to protect, these portfolios delivered that downside protection that they were designed to deliver. So we're quite pleased with the performance of these portfolios. So I could go on with a discussion a little bit about how these portfolios performed.
I think that makes sense, Alan, to dig a little deeper. Some on the line may not be familiar with the unique nature of the monthly income portfolios and how they're constructed. And I hinted at the idea that the income growth, downside protection, maybe we can unpack that a little bit and help people understand how we manage to do what we set out to do here.
Yeah, that's great. So sure. First, I'll start with the downside protection. And longtime followers of these portfolios may know that we have built in three layers of defense here, three specific layers of downside protection. And the first layer is what we call implicit downside protection. That just comes from the asset mix. You know, once you go beyond the 60-40 or 40-60 top-level asset mix and move into the portfolio construction, you really have some interesting things going on here underneath the surface that allow these portfolios to respond actively to market conditions and deliver defensive characteristics. For example, not only do these portfolios hold a meaningful allocation to government bonds and to investment-grade bonds, which are really important asset classes to help deliver good downside protection when equity markets are weak, the share of the investment-grade bonds can rise within these portfolios in terms of the active management. And they did, in fact, rise leading into February. So the share of riskier bonds declined and the share of investment-grade bonds increased as we moved into this downturn. And then on the equity side, we own dividend-paying equities that are very defensive in nature. They're companies that pay dividends, but that they have low debt. They're high-quality companies with a low beta to the market. So they're less volatile just naturally. And so they deliver a decent income, but with an eye to doing this, hopefully in a safer way than we would otherwise. And in addition, on top of that, we own a bit of gold here and there. So that's what I call level one protection, which served us very well. But what really differentiated these portfolios in the downturn was the level two explicit protection that we talk about a lot. And that's that we own put options both on high yield bonds and on the entirety of the equity exposure. So as you know, puts are contracts that rise in value if markets decline towards a specific strike price. So they act a lot like insurance on a portfolio. You hope you never have to use them, but when you do have to use them, they do come in handy because the value of these puts rise and they offset the declining value of the equities in the portfolio so that when we strike a NAV, a net asset value on these portfolios on a daily basis, we have stuff that's gone up to offset the stuff that's gone down. And that is how the NAV of these funds declines by less when markets are down than similar portfolios without that kind of protection. And these increase a lot in value in March. And then we also have a third level protection, and that's a strategic allocation to the U.S. dollar. And as we know, the U.S. dollar tends to react in an inverse fashion to equities. When equities are weak, the U.S. dollar tends to rise. So we have three layers of defense, and they all kicked in nicely through the month of March. In fact, we've quantified the contribution of each of these sources of protection during the peak to trough period running from about February 19th to March 23rd. The put protection alone on the monthly income balance portfolio added 791 basis points of value added. So that's almost 8% just coming from the puts alone. And when it comes to the conservative portfolio, those protective puts on high yield and on equities added 476 basis points. So almost 5% there just from the derivatives alone. And on top of that, we have the contribution from owning the U.S. dollar as a strategic allocation. That added approximately 200 to 250 basis points. And then on top of that, we had the ownership of Canadian government bonds and sovereign bonds, and those added a little bit more to the portfolio in addition. So in total, we had a good 6 to 10% in value added in the peak to trough basis just from these asset classes alone. And Mike, we can talk about what that means. Obviously, the value of having that put protection and the value of having less of a downturn means that just mathematically, these portfolios don't need as much of a recovery to get investors back into the black. you know, to get back onto the positive side of the ledger. As you know, if you have a 50% decline in your assets, you need 100% recovery to break even. But if you only have a 20% decline, you only need a 25% recovery. Now, that's the way the math works. It's unfortunate, but this is an example of how these portfolios strive to get ahead, mainly by losing less in the downturns and then trying to keep up during the good market environments. But they really make their bread and butter during these type of volatile market events where they go down by significantly less than the peer group. And that means that they need much less of a recovery to get back into the positive side of the ledger.
Exactly. And hopefully keeping investors from having to engage in some of the activities they're not particularly good at, like market timing or, you know, moving to the sidelines, trying to call a bottom, or, you know, seeking shelter and safety on, you know, in more safe, secure assets.
Yeah, that's exactly right, because downside protection is only one of the three objectives of these portfolios. That downside protection allows investors to stay invested, because we're also trying to deliver on the other two objectives as well, and that is to deliver a consistent, reliable income to unit holders via our 4% fixed distribution, and then capture as much growth as possible over time. And what happens if you move to the sidelines, if you sell your investments, if you hide out in cash or GICs for a little bit, and then you try and time your re-entry into the market, you find it's very difficult to deliver a decent income. So you take a hit on the income side, and it's very difficult to get back into market. It's always hard to time your re-entry. So it's very difficult to capture as much growth as possible over time. So we'd like to build a construct that allows people to benefit from downside protection, but still stay invested so they can still keep collecting that that regular distribution of income and capture as much as growth as possible over time.
Excellent. That makes sense.
So March was a really good test of these portfolios. But, you know, if we step back a little bit, these portfolios have done a good job of delivering a yield that's in the top quartile of their peer groups over time by holding dividend-paying equities and holding credit-focused investments as well. And also, if you look over a longer period of time, these portfolios, you know, since their inception about 5 years ago, have managed to end up about 2% ahead of the median performance of each of their peer groups over time, if you're looking at annualized performance. So about 190 to 200 basis points in extra annualized performance from these portfolios versus the median performer in their respective peer groups. So really kind of hitting on all cylinders, not only the downside protection that we talked about, but also accomplishing the income objective and then delivering the reasonable ability to not only keep up with their peer groups, but get ahead by losing less. So we're quite pleased. These portfolios were designed to be a long-term core holding for a certain types of investors and certain parts of their investment life cycle. And I think they're so far doing their job.
Alan, perhaps remind people of the yield objective, exactly what they're set out to provide in way of income for investors.
Right. So we put a 4% fixed distribution on these portfolios. That's fixed at 4% at the start of the year. And it's maintained at 4% throughout the year, so it and it's payable monthly. So what that means is that we will try and earn some bond yields, we'll earn some dividend income, and hopefully some capital gains along the way. And those three sources, plus return of capital when we need it, come together to create a 4% payout. So that is why we call these portfolios part of our managed payout solutions that we use across not only in the retail world, but also in the institutional world as well. So we've taken this this idea, this concept, and we've been rolling it out to the endowment universe in Canada because of, as you know, many endowments have a 4% required spending rate. So these portfolios are designed to hit that 4% spending rate on an annual basis. But Mike, we can talk about maybe the retail landscape in Canada and the type of people that we've designed these portfolios for. I mean, I think you've said it best when you talk about late stage accumulators and also retirees or people in the decumulation phase of their life cycle.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. The target market is one we really want to make sure advisors are well connected with.
Right. So late stage accumulators are those people maybe in their 50s, in their late 50s. They see retirement approaching. They don't want to see their savings evaporate when they're just in that home stretch, moving into retirement. And, of course, retirees, or what we call decumulators, but those people that are actively drawing income from their portfolio. So they're actively spending their wealth. And this is a very rapidly growing segment of Canada's population. In fact, it's the fastest growing segment of our population over the next 10 years. And this cohort, we would argue, needs a lot of financial advice. They have common questions about how much do I need to save? How much can I withdraw from my portfolio safely? For how long can I withdraw this money? How long will my money last? These are all important questions that we can help address using the construct of the monthly income portfolios. But I guess the main point is what many people don't realize is that the approach that they've used in their accumulation years is not necessarily the approach that they should be using in their decumulation years. And that's because things change when you start drawing income from a portfolio. Like, we call this the sequence of returns risk. And this sequence of returns risk is, I think, a really important element to understand. It really comes about only when you start drawing income from a portfolio, not before that. It's about getting hit with a very poor, negative sequence of market returns, or basically getting hit with a big equity bear market early on in your investment decumulation career. Imagine if you had retired from work on January 15th of this year, and you had made a plan, you had accumulated assets, you had made a plan to spend a certain amount of money out of your portfolio on a monthly basis. Well, if you get hit with a 20-30% market decline, that means the amount you're pulling out of your portfolio on a percentage basis has just jumped up rapidly. And what you're doing, in effect, is you're reverse dollar cost averaging. You're locking in whatever the market gives you, whether it be gains or whether it be losses. You're basically a forced seller. And sometimes you're forced to sell at market lows. And once you remove money from the account to use for spending, you make that account smaller. That means, therefore, in a recovery, you're going back up the escalator with less than you came down with. And if this is bad enough, or if you do this often enough, you can really damage the ability of your portfolio to carry you through 25 to 30 years of retirement with some safety, you know, some breathing room. And what we know is that if you look at markets since the last, since we have data dating back to 1950, if you just look at the performance of balanced portfolios over that time, or you look at even just the portfolio, the performance of the S&P 500, you've had 10 significant market crashes of 20% or more. And if you take the average, these market crashes have happened about every 6 years. So if you think about it, if you retire in 2020 and you're going to be retired for 25 years, this is going to happen four more times. Maybe not to the same extent that we just saw in March, but this type of event is going to happen to you four times on average in a 25-year retirement. So the question is, you know, do our clients really want to ride this out four more times as they go through what are supposed to be their golden years? We don't think so. This is what we want to protect against. We want to protect against that sequence of returns risk. And I think these portfolios have done a good job at helping to protect there.
And I think you're exactly right, Alan. The one example you often give is that sequence of returns risk in your presentations regarding the million-dollar purchase in an accumulation phase versus the decumulation phase. Do you want to run through those numbers quickly just to sort of illustrate to folks how different it is?
Sure. We've got some great illustrations available from any of your McKenzie teammates that can help in a glossy brochure-type format illustrate this for clients. But one of the pictures in those portfolios, in those brochures, is a fictional million-dollar portfolio invested at the beginning of 1998 compared with a fictional million-dollar portfolio invested at August 1st of 1998. And if you run both of those portfolios forward in time to the end of 2019 and you don't take any money out, both portfolios end up in the multiple millions of dollars. The portfolio that started at the beginning of 98 is worth $4.2 million. The portfolio that started at the midway through 1998 is worth $3.4 million. The reason it's worth less is because way back in 1998, at the beginning of August, you had the Asian credit crisis and the Russian ruble collapse and the collapse of long-term capital management and all these events that have now faded in the sands of time, but were pretty meaningful back in 1998. And anybody who invested right before all those events unfolded got hit with a negative set of returns for a number of months at the beginning of their investment career. Anybody who invested prior to that, say the beginning of 98, got a bit of a gain in the market before getting hit with those events. Now, as I said, if you're not taking any money out, it doesn't really matter. You end up many million dollars ahead over the next 30 years. But as soon as you change this example and start pulling money out of a portfolio, the results change significantly. So the illustration that we show is that second investor with a million-dollar portfolio that is pulling now $60,000 a year out of the portfolio and gets hit with that negative early sequence of events in the middle of 1998, ends up running out of money in 14 years. By the end of 2012, that million-dollar portfolio runs to zero simply because of a negative sequence of returns, whereas that investor that started 6 months earlier at the beginning of 1998 still has nearly $400,000 in their account. So a really vivid illustration of how the sequence of returns using real-life data can actually have a big impact on the longevity of a portfolio and the ability to carry an investor through 25 years of retirement.
Exactly, and why perhaps a different solution is required in retirement than what you used during accumulation. And that's where we're finding a lot of advisors are utilizing the monthly income portfolios. So, Alan, thank you for those comments. Why don't we do this? We're right on time. Why don't we throw it open to questions on the line? I'm interested to see what questions folks have for both you and Paul, and we'll see what we have there. Justina, why don't we pull the lines and have a quick check to see if there's any questions.
Thank you. We'll now take questions from the telephone lines. If you have a question and using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before making your selection. If you have a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. If at any time you wish to cancel your question, please press the pound sign. Press star 1 at this time if you have a question.
Justina, while we're waiting for someone to register their question, why don't we kick it off with a question that's been submitted in prior. It really applies to both, and I'll let Paul handle this one, related to currency. So Alan mentioned how currency is used as one of the three stabilizing factors within the deployment to the U.S. dollar. Paul, lots of folks wondering your opinions on currency, both strength of the U.S. dollar and weakness in Canada. Care to make some comments?
Sure. You know, we coming into 2019, we as a multi-asset strategies team were overweight, the North American currencies. You know, there was that was largely Based on relative interest rate spreads, you know, in favor of the North American currencies. We're in a very different environment now, obviously, because we have been in an environment where it's been complete risk off, and a little bit different because, you know, typically, you know, yen is a beneficiary in a risk off environment, but when things really, seize up and concern, you know, is incredibly elevated. You know, people want nothing but the full faith and credit of the, you know, the United States of America. So, you know, we're still seeing a little bit of that in spite of the fact that those relative rate differentials have disappeared. But of course, the Bank of Canada and Fed, you know, now at zero. Yes, there's still a little bit of relative yield pickup, being in North American currency. But, you know, I think it's still, you know, the U.S. dollar still benefiting from, that flight to safety. So that's kind of the bigger picture on kind of the big dollar, U.S. dollar. On the Canadian dollar side, you know, the obvious challenge is not only do you have COVID-19, but you have the big double whammy with the massive bun fight between the Saudis and the Russians, that has brought, you know, WTI and Brent, you know, down to the low 20s. And at one point in time, WCS below $4. And, yes, we saw the OPEC plus, which is, of course, OPEC plus is OPEC plus Russia, and OPEC plus is, you know, the U.S., Canada, Mexico, other producers. We've seen, you know, plans to reduce supply by just under 10 million barrels a day. That's the one side of it. The other side, of course, is the demand destruction, which is at least that. So from a Canadian dollar perspective, it's hard to see a case for the Canadian dollar firming versus the U.S. dollar. To be honest, our quantitative currency models at this particular juncture have us fairly neutral from a currency perspective. And frankly, it's probably because, you know, sentiment is kind of all over the place. So let me leave it there.
Great. Thanks, Paul. Justina, let's see what questions we have on the line.
Thank you. First question is from John. Please state your full name and go ahead. Your line is now open.
Hi, my name is John, and one question is if we have people that have been holding cash because they feel that the market was overvalued and whatnot. You did talk that there's only been one V-shaped recovery. I guess my two-pronged question is, one, how would you position the cash into the market over the next 6 months or so? And two, where do you think we'd retest the lows on, like, the S&P or wherever these functions are talking? Because you're saying that there's somewhat of a recovery of, but, you know, there we've never had more than a 1V shape in, I guess, the 50 years you've talked about.
Yeah. Okay. So the first one, and I think this fits in with, you know, Alan's conversation to some extent, and that is, you know, this is a great example of a situation where there's so much uncertainty that, you know, kind of a dollar cost average, you know, sort of approach, I think makes a ton of sense. You know, we've had a major market event. I think we expect, you know, that this is a transitory global health issue that we will get our arms around, but there's an awful lot of uncertainty. And you know, that being the case, if someone is fortunate enough to have cash in the sidelines, to put that into the market right away, you know, that's probably not the most prudent course of action, but to take advantage of a market that is still trading, you know, meaningfully, below where it traded, you know, 6 weeks ago, you know, there's some good opportunities in giving money to equity managers who can go out and selectively, like, you know, our managers at Mackenzie can figure out where the best value is, I think makes a lot of sense. So the first one, I would strongly argue, you know, you average into the market. Maybe you take a portion of it. I don't know. Depends, of course, on the risk profile of the client, but maybe you take a third, maybe you take up to a half and then you hold some back just to, you know, to trust but verify that in fact, you know, we're by the worst of the global health crisis. Sorry, your second comment or second question, John, was? I think about validation.
Retesting the lows.
Yeah, now, why would we retest the lows? Well, I mean, we would retest the lows because if I go back to those three points that I said are the basis for the market to form a sustainable bottom, that those lows would be, or that those points that I made would be questioned. And I think the most obvious would be that we're wrong, you know, on the, you know, on reading that we truly have a light on the horizon that we're nearing containment, that we're, you know, we hope that President Trump and Cuomo and others, that they will be in a position, you know, in say the middle of May to start to end the social isolation, and there will be a coherent return to work policy, and it's one that is coherent in that it's hopefully highly likely not to lead to secondary or third, you know, waves of infections. I mean, if we don't get, you know, that assurance, then you know the market definitely, you know, retests that low. But you know what the market is telling us, and a lot of really bright people out there, but you know the market is by far, you know, the brightest of any of us. But the market is telling us that the steps that we're taking are the right steps in terms of social isolation. We're also taking significant steps in terms of developing diagnostics to determine who has immunity to the virus. That we have therapeutics to treat, or that we hopefully will over time develop therapeutics to treat it. And of course, Nirvana is the vaccine. But you know, that would be, you know, what causes us to retest the low. Because at this point in time, everything relates to duration. And that is, if we're out of work for, you know, if we're away from work for 10 weeks, okay, that's fine. We believe that we can handle that. We can absorb that given the stimulus that's been applied. But if we're wrong on that duration issue, and if we're out truly 3, 4, 5, 6 months, that's a very different story. And we have to be realistic about that.
Hey, great questions, John. And we've seen a big uptick from advisors interested in our dollar cost averaging DCA versions, which we have on all of our funds. So if you're looking for ingrained systematic strategies for reinvestment, that's a great way to go. Appreciate your question. Justina, what other questions do we have?
Next question is from Jack DiNardo. Please go ahead.
Hi, sorry, just picking up the speakerphone. I'm just looking at the equity performance. I mean, as much as I want defense, when there is an opportunity to make some returns, I'm just wondering what are you doing to ensure you're, you know, at least in the top half of performance for the peer group. So I'm just looking at how your equity strategy would work in a more stable growth market.
Thanks, Jack. Good question. I think we're cognizant of the fact that the monthly income portfolios are really designed to do two things: provide defense as well as growth along with income, the third element. So, Alan, care to comment on how the portfolio is positioned to achieve its offensive goals?
Sure. In these portfolios, I think it's really important to understand that what we refrain from doing is trying to time the market using the options strategy. So that is really important for people to understand that they will not have to try and estimate or guess or contact us to determine whether we're in bullish mode, bearish mode, or any other kind of mode, because we target to have a fixed degree of protection at all times, and that is approximately 0.7 beta to global equity markets, or to the S&P 500, if you think about it like that. Now, as markets decline, you actually, the way options work is you get a little bit better than 0.7 beta, But as those options roll off and new ones are added or put on, that target returns fairly quickly to 0.7 beta. So if we are at a bottom and we do get a rebound, there's not going to be any change in the operation of these portfolios because, as Paul said, we could just as easily be not at a bottom and we could actually retest lows or go lower. And in that situation, we really don't want to squander a lot of the advantages we've made. That said, within the equity portion, we do have it's split 60% allocated to a actively managed dividend strategy that is constantly searching for strong dividend paying companies that have strong dividends, continue to pay a dividend. So, you know, if we do get dividend cuts around the world from whether it be European banks or U.S. banks or wherever, this is a strategy that will actively basically kick those companies out of the mix and seek out those companies that continue to pay a dividend. And on top of that, 40% is passively allocated to basically call it the S&P 500 or passive indexes. So we should be able to capture and ride up at least a portion of the recovery, keeping in mind that we are basically sitting at 0.7 beta on the way up as well as on the way down, and we are not going to adjust that. Now, within the fixed income side, it's a lot more dynamic. Our use of the McKenzie fixed income team and their unconstrained fixed income strategy, that's a strategy that is now, it was in risk-off mode. It was over 50% investment grade in government bonds and sovereign bonds. And that number is already shifting and is likely rapidly going to shift more towards a much greater exposure to the high yield area now that credit spreads have widened out. I don't know if we're at the peak there. We're going to leave that decision up to the fixed income team. But there is an area where within the portfolios outside of equities that the active management is really hopefully going to kick in and allow us to ride a recovery when it eventually comes.
Excellent. Jack, thanks for your question. Justina, unfortunately, we're coming into the end of the hour, so I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Anyone on the line who had an additional question they want asked of either of our panelists, please send those questions into your sales team. We'll do everything we can to get you an answer. You know, we recognize that you're fielding lots of questions from investors, and we want to make sure that we provide a forum like this one. I thought Paul did a great job of summarizing the characteristics that we need to see in markets from a crisis perspective and response from governments that are going to be the framework around stabilizing this market and moving forward. And then Alan shed some light on you know, one of the unique elements of our product line, really tailor-made for the late-stage accumulator or retirement market, the monthly income portfolios designed specifically to provide income, growth, and downside protection, and hopefully help alleviate some of the need to perhaps market time or move in and out or have people knocked away from the long-term strategy. We appreciate you taking the time to join us on calls like this. Again, we're hosting several calls per week in order to give you access to managers and comments, both from an economic and a portfolio management perspective. I'd urge you to reach out to your McKenzie sales teams for ideas for both defense and offense. I know we're in constant communication with our managers. I would drive folks back to our McKenzie website. The COVID-19 landing page has some terrific updates on calls like this one and other resources that we've been able to pull together. I want to thank you for joining us on today's call, and we recognize that these are extraordinary times, and we want you to know that our thoughts are with you and your families, and we hope that everyone is healthy and safe and understand that we're here to help. Thanks again for joining us, and I would urge everyone to be well. Thanks.
Thank you. The conference has now ended. Please disconnect your lines at this time, and thank you for your participation.